Welcome to What Are You Reading? A podcast dedicated to leadership development through a commitment to reading.
This is your host, Eugene Yang. This week, we're excited to sit down with General David Petraeus. General Petraeus is a partner in the global investment firm KKR and chairman of the KKR Global Institute. He is also a member of the board of directors of Optiv and First Stream, a personal venture investor in 20 startups, and engaged in a variety of academic endeavors. John Petraeus served over 37 years in the U.S. military, culminating his career with 6 consecutive commands as a general officer, 5 of which were in combat, including command of the surge in Iraq, command of U.S. Central Command, and command of coalition forces in Afghanistan. John Petraeus was widely recognized for his leadership of the organization that produced the U.S. Army's Counterinsurgency Field Manual and overhauled all aspects of preparing U.S. Army leaders and units for deployment to combat. After retirement from the military, he served as director of the Central Intelligence Agency during a critical period of the global war on terror, establishing a crucial strategic plan for the agency and invested in the agency's most vital element, its human capital. General Petraeus graduated with distinction from the U.S. Military Academy and was the only individual ever to be the top graduate of his class at U.S. Army Ranger School, as well as the top graduate of the U.S. Army Command General Staff College. He also earned a PhD from Princeton University's School of Public and International Affairs and has held academic appointments at the U.S. Military Academy, the City University of New York, USC, Harvard, and Yale. Sir, it's a real honor to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure is mine. Thanks.
Sir, our first question, we usually like to ask our guests what they're currently reading, but this time we want to put a little bit of a twist on it. And if we can go back in time and ask, sir, what books were you reading during the surge of Iraq, both leading up to it and during it?
Well, the one that comes to mind that was the most important to me was Grant Takes Command, which is one of the classic books on the Civil War. And I found it very relevant, frankly. It was a book that one of the historians at Fort Leavenworth gave to me before I returned to Iraq for the 4-Star Command and the surge. I didn't think much about it. It got thrown in a rucksack. It ended up on the little table by the bunk that I had at that base in near Baghdad International Airport that we used. And I started going through it, and I found it to be absolutely inspirational. I don't want to compare the war that we were fighting in Iraq with the American Civil War, to be sure, but what Grant went through was what I was experiencing, the enormous challenge of casualties and of shortcomings and missteps and dealing with political figures in Iraq, in the United States, in coalition countries, dealing with the realities of the battlefield, and having to drive a campaign forward and to exercise enormous determination and just sheer indomitable will to some degree. You just got to push this forward. And if you remember, the early months of the surge were very, very challenging. I told Congress that it was going to get much worse before it got better, and it did. And of course, folks in Washington were very concerned about that. Needless to say, those of us in Iraq and Baghdad were very concerned about it. We had faith. We did believe that if we did what we set out to do, which was to secure the people by living with them, if we pursued reconciliation with the rank and file of the Sunni insurgent groups and the Shia militia, if we intensified the pursuit of the irreconcilables, the targeted raids each night, if we pursued a comprehensive civil military campaign that built on the security foundation as we achieved it and solidified it, all of these steps, if we did what it was that we intended to do in the surge, that we could truly flip the country, that we could literally drive the level of violence down very, very substantially. And ultimately, that was proven to be correct. But I knew that I faced a return to Washington at the 6-month mark for a public hearing. I went back at the 3-month mark, actually, for behind closed doors hearings. And again, these were rugged. You know, the entire Senate was at one of those, less one or two members. And you know, the questions, understandably, were tough. When are we going to see progress? When is the violence going down? When are these suicide bombings going to be reduced? When are we going to see Iraqis approving legislation to support what it is that we are seeking to do? All the rest of that. And again, in many respects, Grant went through the same. And so I could read about what he was going through and, you know, certainly compare it to what I was experiencing. I remember the Battle of Shiloh, for example, early on in his time in the West. He'd already done the Land Between the Lakes battles at Donelson and so forth. But now he and Sherman are surprised on the first day at Bloody Shiloh, as it came to be known. And they're almost driven back into the Tennessee River. And that night, they're furiously trying to get reinforcements down the river, across the river on a variety of boats, and to disembark them on the shore and to get ready for the next day. That night, you can hear the cry of the wounded still on the battlefield waiting to be rescued. You can hear the cries of soldiers who are having limbs amputated. And Grant is standing out there and with a stub of a cigar in his mouth, you know, that infantry experience of just waiting for the sun to come up the next day, if you will. Sherman comes out of the dark and says, "Well, Grant, we had the devil's own day today, didn't we?" And Grant takes a cigar out of his mouth and says, "Yep, lick him tomorrow, though." And that captured really the kind of spirit that was required at all levels, frankly, during the early months of the surge. Because we were sustaining very tough casualties. There were repeated high-profile attacks, suicide bombings in markets and so forth that were killing, you know, over 100 Iraqis on certain days, civilians. We were fighting a very tough, determined, resilient, and thinking, learning enemy. On two different fronts, mostly the Sunni insurgents early on, but certainly Shia militia as well, and starting to get the campaign going, the clear hold and build, the reconstitution of the Iraqi security forces, taking back control of security from them as we're doing this, beginning the effort to build on the instance of reconciliation that was in existence out near Ramadi in Anbar province, solidifying the civil components of a civil military comprehensive counterinsurgency campaign, and so forth and so on. And we did start to see progress. But again, it was very important to, in a sense, go back and experience through reading what it was that Grant went through. And so that was really a very, very important book at that time. And frankly, it's the only one that really stays with me. It was by Bruce Catton, of course, one of the classic Civil War historians. And, you know, I read a variety of other books during that time, but that's the one that was the touchstone for that period. I really do enjoy biographies very, very much. I think that they should be one of the staple elements of anyone's reading list as a young leader, a mid-level leader, a senior leader. I've recently read, for example, Andrew Roberts' great biography of Churchill. I reread Walter Isaacson's classic biography on Henry Kissinger, which is just wonderful. And then a variety of other books that are just to some degree either contemporary issues or are addressing a variety of historical developments in the industry in which I find myself now, which is, of course, the world of investing and financial markets and so forth. I've read, for example, Andrew Greenberg or Andy Greenberg's Sandworm, which is about the Russian hacking, as you know, I'm sure. David Sanger's The Perfect Weapon. I actually reread Grant's memoirs to come back to him. Again, I see him as an extraordinary figure and someone who's vastly underrated and deserves, I think, a truly Olympian reputation for what he did during the Civil War, where he demonstrated qualities that I don't believe any other U.S. Army general in history has demonstrated in combat, and that is sheer excellence at the tactical level, division and below, say multiple brigades, and that was the land between the lakes, the operational level, clearly one of the great battles of all time, or campaigns really, was his campaign to take down Vicksburg. Others along the way, of course, the fight at the battle above the clouds and so forth around Chattanooga. And then, of course, he comes east. He's given command of all of the Union forces. And for the first time, there is a truly comprehensive strategy for how to employ all the forces and all the theaters. And he then just drives that campaign forward, and he stays with the main effort, which is, of course, Meade. He tells Meade, you go where Lee goes. And he was riding basically in the back pocket of Meade. He's got Sheridan coming down the valley. That's an important victory. Sherman, of course, takes Atlanta and goes to Savannah and then up the coast. And, of course, it was Sherman's victory and then Sheridan's that really were what saved the Union, because they ensured that Lincoln was reelected in the election of November 1864. And that was in doubt up until that time. It was entirely possible that General McClellan could have won. He was, of course, now no longer in the military, and he vowed to sue for peace, and we would not have the Union that we have now. In any event, Grant, I think, someone really worth studying for his command, his leadership, again, during the Civil War. I've recently read and actually interviewed Brigadier General Retired Ty Sedgley, his book, Robert E. Lee and Me, A Southerner's Reckoning with the Myth of the Lost Cause, which is a very, very powerful and frankly quite courageous book, and very, very timely. Rick Atkinson's The British Are Coming, and in fact interviewed him on stage a couple of times as well. And then, you know, looking at the financial industry, Scott Patterson's Dark Pools, about the rise of machine trading. And, you know, I read every Daniel Silva spy novel as well. So it's not just a steady diet of nonfiction. There can be some diversion, amusement, and so forth also. The real takeaway, I think, is that leaders should be readers. You learn, obviously, by doing. You learn by your experiences. You learn by watching others. You learn through the professional development courses that we all experience, this very hierarchical pre-commissioning, basic course, advanced course, staff college, war college, and so forth. But you also learn by reading about others and living vicariously through their experiences. And I think that's a hugely important element of preparing oneself for that moment when you might be called on to perform some particularly important task.
Absolutely. Sir, drawing on your experiences in Iraq, working with the Hill, taking some of those hard questions and staying the course and, you know, getting up every day and getting after it, what are some of the critical lessons learned that we need to retain from our conflicts in the Middle East that will prepare us for future conflicts?
Well, I think there are five lessons we need to learn from the fights of the last 20 or so years against Islamist extremists. And I'll transition then and note that these are no longer by any means the most important fights in which we're engaged or the most important efforts. Clearly, that lies in the great power competition, as it's termed, and the focus, obviously, is the so-called Indo-Pacific, as it is now termed. But I think there are five lessons that we need to take because they are of enduring importance. The first is that Islamist extremists will exploit ungoverned spaces in the Muslim world. The second is you really have to do something about it, because what happens there doesn't stay there. It tends to spew violence, extremism, instability, and refugees, and not just into neighboring countries, but in, say, the case of Syria, all the way into the countries of our NATO allies, causing enormous domestic political challenges for them. So you really do have to take action. Number three is that the U.S. typically has to lead, because we have such a preponderance of the capabilities that are most important in these fights. In particular, this constellation of drones, basically this armada that we can put in the sky, that is so very important. And keeping in mind that we don't just spend more than all of our 29 NATO allies put together, we spend more than twice as much as our NATO allies. So again, that difference between our capabilities and any of the others is vast, and we really are required. But we do want to have allies. We want to have a coalition. We want to have partners. And by the way, that should include Muslim countries, because for them, this is potentially existential, and they have an enormous stake in this. And so we very much, and beyond that, they have understanding here and capabilities and programs that can be very important in a variety of different ways. The fourth lesson is to recognize that you can't counter the kinds of terrorists who are out there, the kinds of extremists like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State and their affiliates and others, with just counter-terrorist force operations. You just can't drone strike or special mission unit raid your way out of these problems. You have to have a comprehensive, essentially civil military counterinsurgency campaign. You can call it what you want, but you need all the elements that were present in the campaigns that we pursued during the surge in Iraq, during the surge in Afghanistan. So it has to, there's got to be a training, equipping, advising, assisting, and enabling element. There have to be the tools that solidify the security foundation and the civil side. There has to be a clear hold and build force. There is a targeted raid element by counterterrorism forces without question, but that's part of, not all that you need to do. It's necessary, but not sufficient. The key, however, is that we don't want to do most of this. And with the capabilities that we now have, particularly the drones, particularly precision attack munitions from the air, and the ability to fuse intelligence, we often can enable others to do the fighting on the front lines, enable them to perform the civil tasks of restoration of basic services, repair of damaged infrastructure, reestablishment of local grievance mechanisms, grievance resolution mechanisms, the reopening of markets, schools, et cetera, et cetera. And again, we want the host nation elements to do that. And we've been able to do that now. We have been able to. We defeated the Islamic State, not ourselves, but by enabling Iraqi security forces and Syrian democratic forces. We have elements on the ground in most of these locations, Afghan security forces, Somali forces, others throughout the world where these are problems. And then the fifth lesson is to acknowledge that this is the fight of a generation, or maybe even generations, not the fight of a decade or a few years. So you have to have a sustained commitment, which obviously should be sustainable in terms of the expenditure of American blood and treasure. All of that, I think, is achievable. And in the bigger picture, in a world where understandably and rightly our focus is shifting to an attention on a near-peer competitor, to great power rivalries and so forth, and in particular the Indo-Pacific region, we have to recognize that we still need to engage in irregular warfare. And I was reassured when the Department of Defense in 2020, I guess it was, released the irregular warfare component of the National Defense Strategy, which was a very tangible recognition that we do need to continue to engage in these kinds of endeavors, that the threat of Islamist extremists is still real, it's still present, it is still very dangerous, but we need to do it in a way that is different from the past, where we are training, equipping, advising, assisting, and enabling forces on the ground there rather than doing it ourselves whenever possible. And our capabilities now allow us to do that. But in the greater context, clearly, if you think of the United States superpower as the guy in the circus who puts a plate on a stick and gets it spinning and then goes over, puts another one up and does, you know, ultimately you have, I don't know how many, 10 plates on sticks spinning and he keeps going back and giving them a twist and keeping them on there. Clearly the plate that is labeled the U.S.-China relationship is bigger than all the other put together. It is clearly the most important focus for our military and really for our entire U.S. government and beyond. It should be a comprehensive, coherent, integrated whole of governments with an S on the end, because we want all of our allies and partners engaged in this with us. An attribute, if you will, that the United States uniquely enjoys, having these allies and partners all around the world. Really, no other country has those kinds of alliances and partnerships. And we should link arms and, to the greatest extent possible, pursue our missions of seeking to deter, if necessary, to prepare to defend with all of these partners and allies. And we'll be much more successful, needless to say, if a would-be adversary sees us linked arms with others and realizes that certain actions should not be pursued, certain behaviors shouldn't be continued or contemplated, etc.
So what do you think are some things we do well to prepare DoD leaders for working with coalition, interagency, kind of whole of government approaches, and with allies? What are ways we prepare leaders to do that that's working for us? And maybe what are some ways we can improve at getting, you know, junior, mid-grade, senior leaders ready to work well and work with our allies that are unique to our posture in the world?
What's that term that we used for engagements on the battlefield?
Key leader engagement, sir?
That's it, yeah. Well, Eugene, if you think about what we did as part of preparing our leaders and units for deployment to Iraq and Afghanistan, and that element of the tasks that take on that's connected with key leader engagement, what did we do in those cases? Well, we sought to understand who the individuals are, the context in which they exist, if you will, their geostrategic situation, culture, institutions, how the system's supposed to work, how it really works, strengths and weaknesses, and so forth. And then we sought, once on the ground, to build relationships, which obviously takes lots of engagement over time. And one of the strengths, actually, of our force over time in Iraq and then also over time in Afghanistan was that we had leaders who had already served there and who had a deeper understanding in that second tour. I spent 4 years nearly on the ground in Iraq, and I knew all the leaders and I knew the context and how the system, again, is supposed to work, the institutions, what their strengths and weaknesses were, what really was going on, all of this. And you have to have a very nuanced understanding of that. So clearly that's what we need to do when we are engaging partners. But what that means is that we've got to have key leaders who are really going to stay with this, who aren't just going to do one exercise in some country in the Indo-Pacific and that's it. Every time that country's leaders engage with Americans, it's a different individual. Again, you've got to have consistency. You've got to have duration. You have to have repeated engagement to actually build a relationship. And ultimately, there has to, needless to say, be a degree of trust and confidence that each has in the other. So if you take what we did on a sort of a community level, a district, a province, even state level in the situations in Iraq and Afghanistan and ultimately in Syria and a variety of other places where we're engaged around the world in irregular warfare. And again, just translate that to, again, the Indo-Pacific, and you focus on certain countries and certain partners and certain activities. And of course, it should be much more than just military. This should be a whole host of other efforts in other sectors and so forth as well. A coherent and comprehensive whole of governments approach, needless to say, includes many other dimensions than just that of the military and defense and security. It's got to have economic, it's got to have trade, it has cultural, it has a whole host of items from, if you will, a menu. And in each of those areas, there needs to be the building of relationships.
So how can we get better institutionally or as an organization when we think about, you know, repeated relationships, you know, not just one exercise out in Indo-Pacific and then having the merry-go-round of now they're dealing with a new person every time? What does that look like in terms of like the larger bureaucracy and getting that to happen with our leaders, especially in a time where we're not at war and maybe in a competition phase?
Well, there's going to have to be a degree of specialization, of targeted focus, of alignment. And of course, we have done this. You have a special forces group, for example, that is aligned with different continents of the country. Certainly all engaged when all hands on deck were needed during Iraq and Afghanistan, without question. But that force requirement has been reduced a good bit so that you can engage in other continents, again, in Africa, in the Asia-Pacific region, the Indo-Pacific. Certainly there are those in Latin America, in Europe, and so forth. And so again, but it should be more than just special forces. It should obviously be other elements that are well suited for these engagement tasks. It might include some of the Army's Security Force Assistance Brigades. And indeed, we have, again, Army and Marine Corps, Air Force and Navy units that are, again, focused on this region. And we need to ensure that leaders are having repetitive tours in that region. I mentioned how important it was that when I went back for the surge, I knew the Prime Minister, I knew the National Security Advisor, I knew most of the generals. And, you know, I've been in the train and equip. I built the Multinational Security Transition Command Iraq in my previous tour with a great team and also the NATO training mission, dual-hatted. And because of that, knew the vast majority of those who were now making their ways up in ranks. Some of them I'd known when they were colonels or brigadier generals, and now they were two or three star generals, and so forth. And the same again with the major political leaders, the major ethnic, sectarian, even tribal element leaders, and political party leaders. So that was hugely valuable. Certainly, you have to get back up to speed, if you will, since you were that last there. That's always going to be the case. But if an individual, if a leader, if a unit has a focus on a particular region, country, then they can stay current on that region, country, even when they're not out there, which is also what I did between the 3- and 4-star tours in Iraq. I would actually, you know, go through the battlefield update and analysis each day that General Casey was receiving out at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, you know, 8 or 10 hours after he got it, given the time zone difference. And with SIPR and all the other capabilities that we have, and now, of course, you can actually do lots of engagement virtually. We've had to do that because of the pandemic, and that's a capability that we shouldn't forget. We've always used secure video teleconference, of course. We used to do global civets, if you will, when I was the commander in Iraq or CENTCOM or Afghanistan on subjects that were literally important, not just to us, but to the rest of the world, particularly nefarious extremist leaders, for example, who may not be in Iraq, but were threatening the entire world and certainly threatening our efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. Again, that's always been part of our repertoire. Now, though, we've done it on a vastly greater scale, and we've shown that you can indeed carry out most of the duties that you used to do in person, again, with these various tools. In the civilian world, Zoom is ubiquitous, and I'm literally on anywhere from, 4 to 6 Zoom sessions per day. And they will involve folks in Europe and Asia, as well as the United States, all at the same time. There are certain hours, obviously, that that's as uniquely possible without dragging people out of the middle of the night. And those are very, very busy ones in particular. But again, that is very, very possible. Noting that obviously there's nothing that really substitutes for that kind of personal sit down and meeting and relationship and shared experiences and all the rest of that.
Sir, so you've led at the highest levels of the Department of Defense and the intelligence community. And earlier we were talking about the unique value proposition of America's drone armada, the importance of intelligence fusion to help our partner nations. I'm wondering, what does the future of DoD and IC integration look like as we scale back from counterterrorism and counter-violent extremism and start gearing up or focusing on near-peer threats, Indo-PACOM, just a different problem set? How is that going to look?
Well, I think it looks fairly similar to what it is that has evolved. And I should note that, of course, since 9/11, there's been vastly greater interaction between our military forces and various intelligence community entities, and also, frankly, just between, if you will, the conventional force and so-called white SOF and so-called black SOF. In other words, there used to be literally sort of barriers between conventional and especially the special mission units. And of course, that all became very, very integrated. It had to be. And I think it just continues. Now, obviously, there will be different, if you will, PIR, the priority intelligence requirements will be different. It may be more, again, nation state, leader, country, region specific than terrorist units or terrorist organization focused. But given just a different geographic focus and so forth, I think you'll see very similar close relations, and those will be necessary. Again, we shouldn't go back in time to the era of stovepipes and literal and figurative fences. I was actually deployed in Bosnia at the time of 9/11. And I was dual hatted already. I was a NATO one star, the Assistant Chief of Staff for Operations for the Stabilization Force. But I also had a second hat as the Deputy Commander of the U.S. Joint Special Operations Joint Task Force Justice Assured Forward. We had a compound that supported that particular mission. It was literally fenced off, and no one would go in there who wasn't actually cleared for that. I remember when 9/11 happened, we decided, hey, we need everybody engaged in this. We've got to start sharing much more widely what's going on. There were actually counterterrorism operations run in Bosnia, in Sarajevo, and elsewhere, as it turned out. And clearly, it needed the involvement of a lot of different elements. We shouldn't reestablish those fences, if you will, or those literal and figurative walls. We've got to maintain the kind of integration, cooperation, sharing, and so forth that actually came to characterize the way we carried out the irregular warfare operations. And we should, again, all stay in the same room and continue to ensure that we have that kind of very close relationship. Noting that obviously there have been changes over the years. One of those is the enormous rise of what is available via the internet, in social media, in a variety of different platforms, and also, of course, in the dark web. But all of that is accessible, really, to anyone, and it needs to very much be exploited and mined and then integrated with the classified products of our intelligence activities. There is, in fact, as publicly known, the Open Source Center, which the CIA runs for the DNI. And over the years, it has become ever more important, given how much can be gleaned and mined from social media and various other activities and various internet platforms.
So kind of along the same vein and kind of bringing in some of your aspects. So you've talked before about strategic leadership, and one of the first essential tasks is to get the big ideas right. And the last one is to make sure we revise the big ideas as the situation changes, as things in society change, the political situation. What are the big ideas we need to get right as we continue to pave the way to understand competition and conflict in the cyber domain? And what do we need to revise if maybe some old big ideas need to be updated based on where we are today?
Well, I think the biggest of the big ideas about cybersecurity is that there is no single product, application, tool that can provide cybersecurity. Rather, you have to have a comprehensive, integrated, managed cybersecurity solution that is built for your particular activity, endeavor, company, organization. And again, of course, it has to be constantly updated. You have to constantly add new capabilities, applications, products, and so forth, and that it has to be very, very actively managed. But that management can't be done by any means just by humans. It's got to incorporate ever more that is possible with machine learning and the incorporation of various artificial intelligence capabilities, because it all has to be at the speed of light, if you will, or the speed of transmission, certainly of digits. And that, I think, is absolutely crucial. That's the biggest of the big ideas, again, about the security component of cyberspace. And just as with strategic leadership, where there are four tasks, it's to get the big ideas right, communicate them effectively through the breadth and depth of the organization, oversee their implementation, and determine how they need to be refined, updated, improved, and do it all again and again and again. There have to be formal meetings, formal activities on leaders' battle rhythm. You know, as they say, this is C-suite business. This is leaders' business, not just that for the cybersecurity staff officer or IT team or something like that. And the way you ensure you force yourself to revisit big ideas, and of course, big ideas have lots of little ideas underneath them, and how you implement them, and tactics, techniques, and procedures, and all the rest of that. You have action-forcing mechanisms, again, on your battle rhythm, in your calendar. You force yourself. During the surge in Iraq, for example, every week I would sit down with the strategic planners, for example, and they would, in a sense, politely confront me with the need to make decisions. You know, if you want to be somewhere 6 or 8 months from now at that level, you've got to make decisions now about that. And then, of course, the operational level commander, the 3-star, will do the same with a little shorter horizon, the 2-stars with a bit shorter, you know, brigade commanders, battalion, company, and all the way down to the platoon leaders that are figuring out what they're going to do tomorrow. you have to force yourself to do that. We had a variety of different actions on the battle rhythm that, again, required me to do that, all the way up to the monthly meeting that I did. I'd spend a minimum of an hour a month with the colonels who were the heads of these different lessons learned teams. They were really lessons identified teams, because they don't learn the lesson. The lesson is learned when it's incorporated in the big ideas and communicated and then executed. But they would all gather as the end of a process that they went through, orchestrated by the chief of staff of the multinational force Iraq or the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan, that hour with me, where each of them would lay out, here are the issues that we believe that we've identified as important to bring to your attention and which you should consider because of the implications they have for the strategy, the various elements of that strategy and how you are implementing it, and operational and tactical and other activities that are ongoing. And those were very important sessions. And that's, by the way, also how you ensure that an organization is a learning organization. Every month at the Division Commanders Conference and the commanders of other 2 and 3 star units in Iraq and Afghanistan, in addition to their normal update of what they were doing to share with all the others, there was also a requirement at a certain point, each of them would share 2 initiatives, new big ideas, new lessons that they had identified and sought to learn that would be relevant to all the others. You're constantly stressing the need to think about the big ideas that you're pursuing, your strategy, your operations, your tactics, what have you, and you're forcing yourself to address where you need to make changes. And if you don't do that, of course, you end up like Kodak, which actually had 2,000 patents on digital photography, but which failed to make the transition, failed to adopt new big ideas built around digital photography, and stayed with film photography too long, and obviously no longer is the business that it used to be. Contrast that with other firms, whether it's Amazon or Netflix or Jack Ma's Alibaba. They're just constantly refining what they do and then adopting new approaches, new big ideas, new use cases, new initiatives. And that's what we've got to do in the military as well, needless to say. That's true of course, the overarching effort, just as it's true of various components of that overarching effort, including, of course, the whole intelligence world, and how we have to shift on the basis of changes in the context where we're conducting intelligence. By the way, the other area in which there's had to be enormous transformation and change has to do with tradecraft. The traditional tradecraft that used to be employed by clandestine services officers just doesn't work anymore in a world of biometric data. Every time you enter and leave a country, and ubiquitous surveillance and cameras and license plate readers and you name it. Again, constant surveillance of activities on the web and so forth. None would be an overstatement, but many of the old elements of tradecraft just don't work the way that they used to. So there's a constant adjustment to the realities in which someone is carrying out the various tasks, whether it's in uniform or in civilian clothes.
Awesome. Sir, any last words of wisdom or advice or leadership stories you want to share for our DoD Reads audience out there?
Sure. Read. Prepare for the moment when the call comes for you to step up. You know, there was that saying attributed to Napoleon, I think, that every corporal carries a field marshal's baton in his rucksack. In other words, you know, at any moment the call could come for, you know, Petraeus for field marshal or what have you. And one way to prepare for those moments, which may, of course, never come, but you never know, the way to prepare to be ready if the call does come, one element of that preparation is reading. And particularly, I think, biographies, contemporary issues, the major strategic developments ongoing around us. That preparation is actually crucial. And I did really try very, very hard to study, to prepare beyond the activities that you're required to pursue as a commissioned or non-commissioned officer in the military, and beyond the experiences that you're having in leadership positions and in positions where you watch or serve other leaders, by again reading. And remember that old phrase that luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity. And one way to ensure that you really are prepared is by very extensive reading.
All right, sir. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for joining us on the show.
My pleasure. Great to be with you. Thank you, Gene.
Thanks for listening to this episode of What Are You Reading? A podcast produced through partnership with DoD Reads. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate, subscribe, and share it. Leave us a comment with your answer to the question, what are you reading? Also, visit dodreads.com for free books, book reviews, interviews with your favorite authors, and many more free professional development resources. See you next week.